Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 1st of May, these are our main stories. Former US President Donald Trump is fined for contempt of court during his hush money trial in New York. An international arrest warrant has been issued for the former president of the Central African Republic, Francois Bozize, over alleged crimes against humanity. Colombia's president says a massive amount of bullets, grenades and missiles have been stolen from the military and sold to criminals. Also in this podcast...
Hey, that's mine.
Hello, Halland.
What the...
Seize him!
The Manchester City footballer Erling Haaland swaps goals for the world of gaming. The judge in Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York has warned him he'll face time in jail if he keeps violating a gagging order. The former US president was fined $9,000 for contempt of court. That was for 9 violations of the order banning him from making public statements about witnesses and jurors. Mr. Trump, the Republican presidential candidate, has pleaded not guilty to charges of falsifying business records to conceal a payment of $130,000 to the adult film actress Stormy Daniels. I spoke to our correspondent, Neda Taufik, who was outside the courthouse in New York, and asked her if the judge appears to be running out of patience with Donald Trump.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the judge had, during a hearing ahead of this decision, told Trump's legal team that they were losing all credibility with the court for suggesting that his posts were merely responding to other political attacks. And in his ruling, the judge said there was only, you know, one post that had a tenuous correlation, as he put it, to words by Michael Cohen, the key witness in this case. Otherwise, he said that Donald Trump had willfully violated the gag order over and over again. And he said that under the law, he's only allowed to fine him $1,000 per violation, but that given Trump is wealthy, it may not even be enough to, you know, convince him that he needs to stop violating the gag order. So he did say that jail time might be a necessary punishment if Trump continues on this course.
But there's a very delicate balancing act here for the judge, isn't there?
There is. Keep in mind that, you know, finding defendants, their lawyers in contempt of court isn't something that happens quite regularly. You have to tie in the fact that this is a candidate for presidential office. The judge, even in his ruling, said that this is someone who he has to balance his right to free speech with the order of this court. And so the judge, you know, said that this is something he had to do to protect the integrity of the system. But he understands that Trump does still have free speech. And that's why we're seeing Donald Trump being able to still attack this judge despite this gag order.
And of course, the trial continues. Who have we heard from?
That's right. We've had a real kind of interesting mix of witnesses that are there to kind of give evidence in a narrative fashion and other witnesses who have been called on the stand simply so prosecutors could enter new evidence in. You know, for example, you had a director of the archives of C-SPAN, which is a public broadcasting service here in the United States, on the stand so they could show videos of Donald Trump saying he didn't know any of these women who had come forward and that Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, was a great friend. So videos to try to hit at his credibility as a witness. But then the last witness we had is Keith Davidson. He is Stormy Daniels, the adult film star who's at the center of this case. It was her lawyer who was on the stand. And he's just been detailing the text messages and conversations that went on with the tabloid The National Enquirer about the negotiations to buy first the Karen McDougal story, that former Playboy model. And I'm sure we'll then get to some of the text messages that led to the Stormy Daniels so-called hush money payment.
Neda Taufik in New York. America's top diplomat Antony Blinken has arrived in Israel after flying in from Jordan. He'll be pushing to secure a ceasefire in Gaza during meetings with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other top Israeli figures. Speaking earlier in Amman, he said Israel had made big concessions.
Our focus right now is on getting a ceasefire and hostages home. That is the most urgent thing. And it's also, I think, what is achievable because the Israelis have put a strong proposal on the table. They've demonstrated that they're willing to compromise. And now it's on Hamas.
On Tuesday, Benjamin Netanyahu repeated his insistence that whatever happens, the city of Rafah in southern Gaza remains a target.
We'll enter Rafah because we have no other choice. We'll destroy the Hamas battalions there. We'll complete all the objectives of the war, including the repatriation of all our abducted people.
The head of the UN, Antonio Guterres, warned that an assault on Rafah would be an unbearable escalation. Hamas is yet to decide on whether to accept the terms of the latest ceasefire proposals, hammered out during mediated talks in Cairo. The US said there should be no more delays or excuses. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Frank Gardner, reports.
While Hamas ponders the proposed truce deal that could see dozens of Israeli hostages released, hardliners in Mr. Netanyahu's coalition have publicly threatened to walk out if that deal goes ahead. So today, he reverted to ground that both he and they feel comfortable on, vowing to press ahead with a military assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, something the US and Britain strongly oppose. Israel's ground offensive in Gaza has all but petered out, but its military believes the last remaining battalions of Hamas are in Rafah, as well as quite possibly its fugitive leader, Yahya Sinwar, the mastermind behind the October the 7th massacre. The US does not believe Israel could conduct such an operation in Rafah without unacceptably high civilian casualties. And now Mr. Netanyahu has a new problem. He is worried, some say terrified, that the International Criminal Court in The Hague is poised to issue arrest warrants for him and other senior Israeli leaders relating to Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. This possibility, he said today, is a scandal on a historic scale. He called it an absurdity, a distortion of justice and history, and an unprecedented anti-Semitic hate crime.
Frank Gardner. An international arrest warrant has been issued for the exiled former president of the Central African Republic, François Bozize, in connection with alleged crimes against humanity. Will Ross reports.
The Central African and foreign judges at the court in the capital Bangui say there's evidence that François Bozize is criminally responsible for atrocities committed by soldiers under his command. Members of the Presidential Guard and other security forces are accused of murder, forced disappearances, torture and rape. The former president will only face trial if the authorities in Guinea-Bissau, where he's in exile, agree to hand him over. In late 2020, Mr. Bozize tried to seize power again, but the rebel group he still heads was pushed back from the capital after Russia sent in hundreds of paramilitaries from the Wagner group.
Will Ross. In cases of cybercrime, we often think about people hacking into bank accounts or secret government documents. But in Finland, a case has concluded regarding something a good deal more personal. Julius Kivimäki has been jailed for 6 years after attempting to blackmail over 30,000 people with confidential notes from their therapy sessions. Our cybersecurity correspondent Joe Tidy gave me more details.
We sometimes hear, very rarely, but it does happen, of medical records being stolen by hackers. But this was about your therapy notes. This is about your mental health, which is arguably even more sensitive. So there were around 33,000 people in the database who had had their notes that had been taken by their therapists, accessed and stolen and downloaded by Kivimäki. as well as other things, for example, your address, your email account, and no financial records, but obviously also where you live. And the blackmail at the time was, pay me or I'll publish online. And then in the end, he did.
And this isn't the first time that Kivimäki has been on the radar of the police in Finland.
No, he's an infamous name. I first came across him in 2014, so nearly 10 years ago, when he and his cybercrime gang called Lizard Squad, this is a teenage gang, so they come up with these silly names, they attacked Xbox Live and PlayStation Network at Christmas and brought these services down for potentially hundreds of millions of people on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So this was an individual who's been in the scene for a long time, revelled in the chaos that you can cause through cybercrime, and then was convicted in 2015 of some of those crimes as a teenager, given a suspended sentence, so not really much of a deterrent. And at the time, the fear was this isn't enough to put off someone like Kivimäki. And lo and behold, this big hack happens in 2020, which he's now been convicted of.
And how is he viewed in Finland?
Oh, he's absolutely hated. You can imagine, this is an individual who, in the words of the prosecution, ruthlessly targeted vulnerable people. And not only that, Finland is a small country. So I went over to Finland to witness some of the court case myself. And the feeling there is that everyone in Finland knows someone or is an individual themselves who have been a target and been a victim of the Fostamo hack. And this hack, it's hard to overestimate how much of an impact it's had on the country. It's the largest criminal investigation and criminal trial in history by numbers of victims. And even the company itself, Fostamo, which has obviously now collapsed into bankruptcy, its CEO has been convicted himself. That all came crashing down, this fast-growing, well-respected company that was really filling a gap in society of providing mental health care to people that need it.
Joe Tidy, the European parliamentary elections take place in early June. In France, the story of the moment is the runaway lead of the far right, the national rally of Marine Le Pen and her young co-leader, Jordan Bardella, stand at 32% in the polls. That's around double its nearest rival, the party of President Macron. Our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield, has been finding out what's driving up the party's support. And he starts by taking us to the cathedral town of Sens, 160 kilometres southeast of Paris.
The national rally is on a roll, and it knows it. Never has the party seemed so full of confidence. Here at the annual spring fair in Sens, Jordan Bardella, the unfeasibly young party president, he's just 28, is being welcomed like a hero. Sometimes you have to pinch yourself. This is the far right, the ex-National Front, the untouchables. And now, here in the French provinces, totally normal.
We came for a photo of Jordan, and we got it. So we are happy. He's so young, but that's good. Macron was young too, so maybe Jordan can take over.
So what's pushing the party so high? Events are certainly helping. Inflation is biting. President Macron, out here anyway, is very unpopular. And now there's been a run of atrocious stories of violence among immigrant communities in schools. In the Paris suburbs, a 15-year-old, Shamsedine, was beaten to death, seemingly by the brothers of a teenage girl angry that she was in contact with him. The case is not unique.
The strength of the French National Rally, Rassemblement National.
For the National Rally's newest star recruit, it translates into a crying popular demand for more authority. Fabrice Leggeri is a big catch for the National Rally. He's the former head of the EU's frontier agency Frontex and strongly of the belief that uncontrolled immigration is a factor in much of the violence.
This is a cultural clash. The fact that some boys, teenagers, consider that their sister shall not talk to a boy, that this is a matter of honour, and this is not part of our culture. In France, it's not part of our culture, I'm sure, nowhere in continental Europe or in the UK.
The recruitment of senior figures like Leggeri is another reason why the National Rally is riding high. New social categories, not just the white working class, are being attracted to the party as it gains respectability. Christelle Craplet of the opinion pollsters BVA.
We see that a lot of people belonging to upper classes, a lot of old people, but also young people could consider this vote. It's not seen as a taboo as it used to be for the older people, younger ones or upper classes. That is something which is very different than before.
Back on the campaign trail in Sens, I asked Jordan Bardella what was his party's response to what he calls the savagery of society. His answer, toughness and then more toughness. It's uncompromising, but quite clearly a lot of French agree.
Hugh Schofield reporting. Some of Europe's most common tree species will probably not survive this century because of climate change. That's the conclusion of researchers at the University of Vienna, who say that between a third and half of tree species will not be able to cope with future conditions. And they say that should inform which trees are planted now for reforestation. Peter Wohlleben is the author of The Hidden Life of Trees. Sarah Montague asked him what he thought about the research.
This is the typical mistake some scientists make regarding a forest as an assembly of trees. We know from other studies that native forests are reacting perfectly in times of climate change. For example, that some bacteria can switch off and on genes in trees, and trees therefore get more drought resistant. So I'm not going 100% with this new study.
Right. So you think forests, trees, are what, much more resilient? Because there's a very wide range of weathers and climate expected over the next few decades, from very wet to increasingly hot.
Exactly. For example, the Gulf Stream is getting weaker and weaker, and especially for Great Britain, the scientists say that the climate became, in winter times, much colder. So which climate are we expecting? We don't know. We know that it is becoming an average warmer, but locally that can mean something very different. So I don't like those forecasts saying that trees may not withstand the climate in 10, 20, 40, 50 years because we don't know the local climate.
Do you think that they can adapt at the speed that we expect the climate to change at?
We first thought that an adaptation can occur between generations, and that means that it takes hundreds of years that trees adapt. And now we know trees are learning not exactly, but nearly in the same speed we do. So from one year to another, we see that trees are adapting. And the best thing is that they give this knowledge to their seedlings in the same time, so that the next generation of trees, which is still growing under the mother trees, are much better adapted than the old trees. So they are not that slow that we thought.
Okay, to listen to you, I mean, you make them sound almost human.
The thing is, and I know that there are some critics that it's too that I'm anthropomorphizing trees, but to be honest, how should we understand other beings without transferring it in our world of understanding? So, and nature didn't invent a special way just for us and another way for all other beings. So that we are under the same rules, they are the same principles, and it's no wonder that many, many species around us are reacting in the same way. They are learning, they are adapting within a certain range. So we shouldn't lay back and say, okay, they will do the job and we can go on with our greenhouse gases. No, we should stop it now. And there are good rules on the way, new laws. And I'm an optimist. I think we will make it.
Peter Wohlleben, author of The Hidden Life of Trees. Still to come.
When she first said that there were monsters, we had just actually watched Monsters, Inc. At the time, I was 3 months pregnant and thought maybe this is a regression of some sort.
So, was this just a figment of a child's overactive imagination? Find out later.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions, because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times
to be the first to climb all 8,000-meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Coast Guard vessels from China and the Philippines have clashed in one of the most hotly contested waterways in the world. The Chinese fired water cannon as the Filipino boats tried to deliver food and fuel to fishing vessels around Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. The area was seized by China in 2012. The BBC South Asia correspondent Jonathan Head was on board one of the Filipino boats and sent this report.
This is how China defends its claim to the entire South China Sea. Water cannon raking the deck of a Filipino Coast Guard ship, soaking everyone. We were just off Scarborough Shoal, a coral reef that's claimed by both countries, but much closer to the Philippines.
This Coast Guard ship has already attacked this ship once. It's water cannon and blasted the decks. As you can see, it's spraying water in the air. That's a threat. It's very likely it's going to come back and hit us again.
The Chinese attacks continued for half an hour. This is a familiar ordeal for these Filipino crew members who must conduct these missions while greatly outnumbered by the flotilla of Chinese ships outside. All morning, we watched them shadowing us, and they watched us back, before moving in for a risky game of maritime cat and mouse.
Well, this Chinese Coast Guard ship has come so close now. There's only perhaps 40 or 50 metres between us. This is a very aggressive tactic. The Philippines crew are preparing to throw buoys over the side in case there's a collision between the two.
After years of relative inaction, the Philippines is now pushing back against China's dominance in these waters, encouraged by the firm backing it's had from the United States. The Chinese presence here is overwhelming, though. In the end, our ship was forced to return to Manila. And there's always the possibility that these increasingly combative encounters in this strategically sensitive region escalate into something bigger.
Jonathan Head reporting from the South China Sea. And there's a video of that incident and background to the tension in the South China Sea on the BBC website. The issue of corruption in Colombia's military is on the agenda once again. President Gustavo Petro says missiles, thousands of grenades and over a million bullets have all gone missing and says corrupt members of the armed forces are to blame. Our America's regional editor Leonardo Rocha gave me more details.
It all came from a statement by the president, Gustavo Petro, next to the head of the military. He gave a very detailed list of what went missing in the inventory of two of Colombia's main military units. And that has surprised everyone. What President Petro said is that the people behind that need to be punished. And he said it's down to corruption, corrupt military personnel who have taken guns and ammunition and sold it to criminal groups and possibly to rebel groups as well.
And of course, Colombia's military has been active over many years, but it seems they may have been inadvertently, perhaps, as far as the hierarchy are concerned, they may have been arming their enemies.
Yes, that's something that doesn't go down very well. Amazingly, something that happens across Latin America. You have the police selling guns to criminals who then fight them and kill them. It's really bad. You had this week a helicopter crash that killed 9 Colombian soldiers who went to fight the Gulf Cartel. They're now the main drug trafficking gang. You have other rebel groups involved in fighting the government. Criminality is really a problem in Colombia, and organized crime. And the problem here you have is that the Colombian military, they're very well armed. I mean, compared to other countries in the region, they have received an estimated $10 billion from the United States to fight the drug cartels. So they have a lot of weapons. And for some people, this is just a matter of short-term profit.
And I can't imagine the Americans will be too impressed either, because the money they've given to Colombia to fight the drug wars was a major plank of their foreign policy.
Yes, they still help the Colombia. They're still involved with the Colombian army. They won't be happy at all. And I think in Colombia, people will be furious because criminality is on the rise. After the peace process with the FARC, which failed in some ways, many of the former rebels went into criminality, went into drug trafficking, and that is a problem. And you have a history of problems with the Colombian army, including corruption, including human rights violations, of course, not everyone. But President Petro says he's determined to fight that, and he said more might be found when they do an inventory of all the military units across the country.
Leonardo Rocha. One of the biggest names in crypto finance has been sentenced to 4 months imprisonment after pleading guilty to money laundering last November. Changpeng Zhao is the billionaire former chief executive of Binance, the largest crypto exchange in the world. Tim Franks heard more from Joshua Oliver, a journalist with the Financial Times.
CZ, as he is universally called in crypto by his initials, was effectively charged with failing to prevent money laundering in Binance, which is absolutely an enormous cryptocurrency enterprise. And it's important to emphasize just how much money is flowing through this company on a daily basis, billions and billions of dollars. The U.S. government said they had an obligation to be checking and making sure money wasn't flowing to drugs, to human trafficking, to terrorists, to criminal organizations. And Binance has now effectively pled guilty to saying that they didn't have the proper checks in place to stop money laundering. And it's for that that he's now been sentenced to 4 months in prison.
Mm. Lots of people are drawing parallels, of course, with Sam Bankman-Fried, who got 25 years for his role in crypto financial fraud. I mean, that was obviously a different case, and it was he didn't plead guilty. But it's a massive contrast, isn't it, in terms of the length of time they're going to serve?
It's really striking. I mean, obviously, you know, by the lights of the U.S. legal system, both are sort of, you know, technically fair decisions. But I think it's very, very odd that you see, you know, the Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX case was one that was quite sort of intuitive for people. Their money was stolen from everyday individuals. And so, you know, that carries a heavy sentence. But I think that the Binance case was really, really serious and probably deserves more attention than it has gotten so far. Because, you know, we are talking about money, as the Justice Department alleges, going to terrorist groups like Hamas, money going to criminal organizations, to the dark net. And it is really important that there are proper checks in place to stop this kind of thing from happening. And it's also ultimately a case about the, you know, the ability of governments and of countries to impose some certain level of control on this cryptocurrency industry.
The financial journalist Joshua Oliver. Next, to the world of gaming, where Manchester City striker Erling Haaland is the first footballer to become a character in one of the world's most popular mobile games, Clash of the Clans. Known for his prolific goal scoring, the Norwegian will now take up a new role, ruling fantasy villages as the Barbarian King. But how did it all happen? Here's Alfie Halbersham.
The trailer shows Erling Haaland sat at home, smiling to himself on the sofa, before, all of a sudden, a group of animated elves and skeletons appear in his living room.
Hello, Haaland.
What the?
Seize him! Give them fire! Not so fast!
Using fireballs and swords, they whisk him into a portal where he becomes an animated character in Clash of the Clans. And he certainly looks the part. The almost 200-centimetre tall Norwegian with his flowing blonde hair is often likened to a modern Viking. And on the football pitch, he's known as the Terminator, shrugging off defenders in his way as he bursts towards the goal. So, probably quite a good fit for his new role of slinging explosives at dragons in enemy villages. But he's not the only footballer who's taken the gaming plunge. Argentina's Lionel Messi and Brazil's Neymar Jr. have already both made their debuts on the battlefield as characters in Call of Duty.
Oh, look at this! Neymar!
But anyone wanting the thrill of playing as one of them would have to part with $20. and it's still not known how much of that made it into their own pockets. But it's not all about the money, because today's footballers are often fans of gaming themselves, an industry that made $400 billion in revenue last year, more than film and music combined. And in the case of Erling Haaland, he was the one who reached out to Clash of the Clans to ask to become the Barbarian King. He says it's a game he's been playing since he was 10, describing it as a really cool moment.
Alfie Harbershern reporting. When three-year-old Sailor Class began complaining of monsters in her bedroom, her parents thought it was just a figment of a child's overactive imagination. But then a beekeeper discovered tens of thousands of honeybees in the walls above her bedroom in the family home in Charlotte in the US state of North Carolina. James Reynolds spoke to Sailor's mother, Ashley Massis, and began by asking her what did she think about her daughter's comments initially.
When she first said that there were monsters, we had just actually watched Monsters, Inc. At the time, I was 3 months pregnant and thought maybe this is a regression of some sort, or she's pointing towards the closet and we're watching a movie, so it would make sense. At night, we had a bedtime routine of going in and pretending to look for all the monsters, and we gave her a spray bottle of water for monster spray.
Wow.
It went on for months, and we thought this was just a normal overactive three-year-old's imagination.
When you went into her room, did you see any evidence of the bees that you eventually found? I know you had a monster spray, but you weren't looking for bees.
No, not at all. And, you know, what's funny is when all of this happened through the past couple months, I slept on the floor in that room with her. I didn't hear anything, but we learned later from the beekeeper that when she started to get very adamant about it, it wasn't until springtime when a couple of weeks ago when we started to see some bees come in and out of our attic vent that we said, oh, we should just get a pest control spray.
And at what point, I mean, here's the big reveal of the story, did you work out, hold on, the monsters she's thinking about are the bees?
She started to get really heightened and wanting to sleep in our room. And we thought maybe she's hearing bees in the attic. So we had the beekeeper come back, and he actually watched. He cut a hole into our attic wall. We have a 100-year-old house, and so we've been slowly renovating each room. And this was one of course, the renovated rooms that need to be cut up. And he cut into the hole in the wall, and he saw the bees go down into the floorboards and said, what is underneath? And we said, it's our daughter's room.
Oh, was that the big light bulb moment?
Not yet.
Okay.
It was, you know, we thought, okay, maybe it's still the ceiling. But then he had a thermal camera and it lit up like a Christmas tree. It was insane. At first, what we saw, and you can see in the video that I had put on social media, it looked almost like a man. It's like, what are we looking at here? And he said, this is one of the biggest hives I've ever seen. It's floor to ceiling.
Wow.
And so then,
okay, that's huge.
Huge. And then it clicked. Oh my goodness. She was not pointing at her closet. She's pointing at the wall next to her closet.
Oh my goodness. And did you have to sit down with her and say, you know, the monsters that you thought were monsters, well, they're you were right about it, kind of. They're actually bees.
So what we did is he actually was able to extract over 20,000 bees in the specialized bee box the first day. And he had it outside sitting on our porch. And so she came back from school, and my husband and I had come up with a game plan that we're going to talk to her and tell her, you know what, these were the monsters. They're honeybees, but that is what the monsters were. And what was very wonderful of our beekeeper is he came out and he had the hat on and everything, and he introduced himself as the beekeeper. And she said, no, you are a monster hunter.
Oh.
And that was it.
Ashley Massis from Charlotte in North Carolina. And her daughter was right all along. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nora Huell. The producer was Liam McSheffrey, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed, but whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.